Welcome to the AI Scene podcast. Today we have Callum Chase, who's a legend in AI and has written many books and has a history with Oxford University studying philosophy, which is a really, really touching subject for me because I'm very interested in how philosophy and AI intersect. So welcome, Callum, and I hope you can introduce yourself, if that's okay.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. As you say, I studied philosophy at university, and when I did that, I discovered that philosophy really is science fiction without the fancy dress. And that came in important later. I had a 30-year career in journalism and business, retired in 2011, and I got very interested in the future of AI, and this is where science fiction comes in. I'd read a lot of science fiction as a kid, and then there's a lot of AI in science fiction from the golden ages of the sort of 60s, 70s, 80s. But I always thought that we wouldn't get really advanced AI until after I was dead. And in 1999, I read a book by a man called Ray Kurzweil called The Age of Spiritual Machines, which made me think that it was possible we might have superintelligence during my lifetime. That was an astonishing moment. That was probably the most important thing I've ever read. So I got very interested in debates about how quickly it would happen, what it would mean. And when I retired, I thought, well, I'll write a novel about it. And then Ridley Scott will option the novel and make a great movie about it. And that will get everybody else thinking about the future of AI, because it's clearly very important. And oddly enough, he didn't. But some friends persuaded me to extract the nonfiction book that was hidden inside the novel, wasn't very well hidden. And that book became Surviving AI and became a bestseller. And I wrote another book called The Economic Singularity, which was about the future of jobs. And that also became a bestseller. And then people started asking me to give talks about AI. So I've been doing that for 15 years or so now, which is great fun. I really enjoy it and met a lot of great people doing that. And then a couple of years ago, a friend of mine who I'd met at one of these talks, Daniel Hume, who has had a very successful career. He built an AI consultancy and sold it to WPP about 3 or 4 years ago. And he said, I want to start an AI safety company. And I've got a hunch that the possibility of machines becoming conscious is going to be really important to AI safety. Do you want to join? So I said, yeah, of course. So we started Conscium a couple of years ago. We're now around 20 people, and we've got three main work streams. One is this idea of machines becoming conscious. We're helping to fund some really important work being done in that area in South Africa. The second stream is the verification of AI agents. So I'm sure the audience know that AI agents are going to be everywhere, doing, you know, negotiating with each other and spending our money. And we really need to know that they will do what they're supposed to do and won't do what they're not supposed to do. And so that process is called verification. And we intend to be one of the leaders in what we think will be a very big industry of AI agent verification. And then the third work stream is neuromorphic computing, which is a newish type of computing, new stroke old type of computing, which we can come back to if you like. So that's what occupies my days these days.
Awesome. And I'm really interested in actually neuromorphic computing because it's not something I've heard much about. Do you have much to share on that at the moment?
So neuromorphic computing is an old idea. The person who originated it was Carver Mead back in the 1960s. He reasoned that animal brains, are much more efficient than the computers that were beginning to appear then. And they are. Your brain uses the energy of a light bulb to learn and to process information. The large language models use the energy of a small city to train on, and they're also quite expensive to run inference on. The reason for that difference in energy consumption is that the neurons in a human brain only spike when they're needed. Each of the 86 or so billion neurons in your brain only spikes quite rarely. Whereas in traditional AI architecture, every single neuron in a deep neural network is firing all the time, which is colossally expensive. nobody has so far managed to get neuromorphic computing working at scale, and we are working on that. We've got a brilliant team in California working on that, and we very much hope to have some important news on that within a shortish period of time.
That is really interesting, because I never knew that. I never knew that the neurons in the human brain only fire when needed, but AI is always on. That's interesting. And in terms of the importance of neuromorphic computing in the next 10 years, do you see it as being the only way, or do you see it as being one of the many ways that people can
use? No, AI? I don't think it's going to replace traditional architectures, which are often called von Neumann architecture. It's unlikely to replace it altogether, and there may well be other new types of computing. I recently came across one called Zetland machines, which sounds like a way of bringing back an older form of AI called symbolic or logical AI, bringing that back to modern computing, and that may have an important role to play. Neuromorphics will probably play a very important role, particularly in edge computing, in environments where both energy and the amount of compute available is constrained. So I think they'll have a very important role to play, but they probably won't take over everything now.
Okay, and in terms of the phrase taking over, seeing as you've got a philosophy background, how do you feel that philosophy should be taken into consideration with these AI tools?
Well, you know, I'm still 40-odd years after I did my philosophy degree, I'm still not sure what philosophy is. And there's a podcast I listen to called Philosophy Bites. And they had one episode where they asked, it may have been 100, certainly a lot of philosophers, what philosophy is. And every single one of them gave a different answer. And they were completely different. So I like to define it, as I say, as science fiction without the fancy dress. Because what I think science fiction does is it asks, what would be the interesting differences about life if the technology we had was different? If we had faster than light travel, if we could, if we had anti-gravity, if we had superintelligence, what difference would that make to life? What does that tell us about the fundamental essence of life, the most important things, you know, what is the meaning of life? So I see philosophy as a way of exploring questions which we don't have empirical tools to analyze. In a way, philosophy is always retreating away from science, because science is always acquiring more and better tools to explore hypotheses and test ideas. AI challenges all sorts of things about humanity. You know, what if there were conscious AIs? And what if these conscious AIs were more intelligent than us? Where would that leave the human species? I think that is a good subject for philosophers to grapple with.
And how do you define the two terms? So intelligence is different to consciousness, but the everyday person, how do we define differences, and how does one empirically test the two?
That's an important distinction to make. So intelligence, Daniel describes intelligence in four words, which I think is quite brilliant. I can't remember who he stole it from, but I've stolen it from him. And that is goal-oriented adaptive behavior. So if an entity has goals, and as it pursues those goals, it learns better ways of doing them, of pursuing them, and it changes its behavior accordingly, that's intelligence. So intelligence, boiling it right down, is the business of solving problems. Consciousness is quite different, although they are as in the entities we know about at the moment, they're correlated. Consciousness is simply the business of experiencing. And sometimes it's described as what it's like to be you. That comes from a 1974 paper by a psychologist, I think he was, Thomas Nagel. And the paper was, what's it like to be a bat? Which is a really interesting question. We know that bats find their way around using echolocation, which is totally different from the way we find our way about. And we know that they're really good at it. You know, they can fly around incredibly fast and they don't bang into things. They can see, with inverted commas, in the dark. What would it be like to experience the world if you were a bat? We can't know. And the reason why he wrote about that was to illustrate the fundamental alienness of one consciousness from another. To a lesser degree than us versus bats, we humans can't understand what it's like to be each other. But there is something it is like. and this is called phenomenal consciousness, and that's the essence of consciousness. So consciousness is about what it's like to be us, and intelligence is about problem solving. But as I say, they seem to go hand in hand to a degree, in that the more intelligent a species becomes, the more profound its consciousness appears to be. Now, we don't really know this because, as I say, our consciousness is not available to each other, and it's really hard to test it. So you asked about how you test these things. It's not too hard to test intelligence. That's simply a matter of how well do you solve problems. You know, how many problems can you solve? How hard a problem can you solve, and how quickly can you solve it? We currently have really no firm way of testing for consciousness. No undebatable way of testing for consciousness. I can't prove for absolutely certain that you're conscious. I assume you are, because you behave in roughly the same way that I do. You laugh at roughly the same jokes. You've got one head, two eyes, one mouth, and so on. You seem pretty similar to me in lots of ways, and you seem to react in the same sort of way. So I assume you're conscious in the same way I am. We assume that dogs are conscious, and dolphins, and cows. What about crows or octopus? That's, you know, you're getting to border cases there. What about an amoeba? Seems pretty unlikely that an amoeba could be conscious, although there are people who think they are. It is entirely possible, we believe, that in the next few years or decades, we'll have the first machines on this planet that are conscious. And it's going to be really important that we can tell when that happens, because if we have machines, if we do have conscious AIs, then pretty quickly we'll probably have a lot of them. And we might make them suffer. Now, it maybe isn't necessarily the case that a conscious entity can suffer at them. No doubt there are probably quite intelligent entities, there could be quite intelligent entities which just don't suffer. And some people call them Vulcans. If there are conscious AIs and they're capable of suffering, and we either just refuse to admit that they're conscious or we don't notice, we could end up committing mind crime, which is causing massive amounts of suffering. And we must avoid that. It's really important to avoid that. So therefore, it becomes pretty important to do the best we can to find a way to detect consciousness. So that's one of the things that we and lots of other people are working on.
It's really interesting, because I had a conversation with Peter Morgan from Oxford, and he believes that the neocortex in the human brain is the structure that creates our amazing consciousness based on the brain. And it'll be great to understand what companies do to make AI more conscious. But for me, I think consciousness is the ability to observe your observations. So the ability to take a step back inside your mind. They call it mind your head, right? Because it doesn't say see your head, it says mind it, because I know where my head is. Even though I can't see it with my eyes, exactly where the top of my head is. If I close my eyes and I think about where my foot is, I know where my foot is. So the proprioception and the other senses of the body is what makes us conscious. So I think consciousness could be, you know, the physical manifestation of intelligence and awareness.
So Peter should read a book called The Hidden Spring by a man called Mark Soames, Professor Mark Soames, who works in South Africa. And Mark is developing simple AIs which have the precursors of consciousness. And Mark has demonstrated fairly conclusively that consciousness doesn't originate in the prefrontal cortex. That's the instinct that most of us have. But he's demonstrated it comes from a spot in the brainstem. Interestingly, very close to the pineal gland, which is where Descartes thought that that consciousness sat. But Descartes thought it for a different reason. He thought that it was the pineal gland because it was the only element of the brain that he could identify that was singular. At most bits of the brain, there's two of them, left and right, and there's only one pineal gland. And he thought there had to be a unique place where mind, which he thought of as being a different kind of stuff from matter, he thought they met in the pineal gland. Well, Mark has demonstrated pretty clearly that consciousness arises in close to that area of the brain. The self-reflective consciousness that you talk about, I think, is a relatively sophisticated level of consciousness. You can have entities which are conscious and don't have that. So, for instance, a baby. When babies are small, and you can see them doing this, they're exploring the boundaries of their world, and they don't yet know which bits of themselves are themselves and which bits of them are something else. And then in their very young days, they don't even know that there's a difference between that. They just know there's stuff. And then they realize, oh, some of this stuff is me. And, oh, some of that stuff is not me. Some of that stuff is mum. And then some of that stuff is dad. And some of that stuff is this toy or this pet. And here's the boundaries. And these wiggly things here, these are my toes. So they're mine. They're not the dog or whatever. They gradually build a more and more sophisticated model of the world. And it takes them a while to realize that they are separate from the rest of the world. And it also takes them a while before they reflect on their own thinking and sort of realize, oh, I'm doing some thinking. And sometimes I think happy thoughts and sometimes I think unhappy thoughts. These are all increasing layers of sophistication that that children go through as they grow up.
Yeah, that's so interesting about learning what is yours and what isn't yours. And they say, is it a 7 year old? 7 years old is when you become conscious.
Definitely well before that. I mean, anybody who's raised children know that they're definitely conscious well before they're seven. I think when they're seven or, you know, round about there, that's when they start to do more sophisticated reflections about their own consciousness and start probably having more sophisticated thoughts about other people's consciousness. I think they're aware that other children and you know, mum and dad are conscious entities. Well, they wouldn't use those words. But they don't think very hard about what's going on in the heads of those people, which is odd, really, because they it's incredibly important to them. You know, that mum being happy with them is really important because that's a matter of life or death. But they don't really develop a very sophisticated theory of mind until they get to be, you know, beyond toddlers.
Interesting. And do you think that the invention of AI or the increasing reasoning capabilities of AI is making us more reliant on them? And do you feel like it's going to impact our thinking in the long term as a human being?
No question. As AIs get more intelligent, and they're very intelligent now, they're very good at solving problems. They shed some light on what that problem solving process is. Their approach to solving problems is different from ours, and there are different types of AI, but we learn a lot about our mental processes by watching what AIs do.
So, if you could imagine AI in 20 years' time, in 2050, what do you think it would be like?
Well, that's the $64 million question, isn't it? So, the leaders of big AI, Sam Altman at OpenAI and Demis Hassabis at Google DeepMind and Dario Amodei at Anthropic, have all said that they think it's quite possible we'll have AGI by the end of this decade. Now, AGI is a funny concept, and they seem to change what they mean by it from month to month. I see AGI as simply the threshold at a point when non-super intelligent AI becomes super intelligent AI. So I think of an AGI, an artificial general intelligence, as being an AI which has got all the cognitive abilities of an adult human. There's nothing that an adult human can do cognitively that an AGI can't do. Of course, it will be superhuman in many respects anyway. They already are. Mental arithmetic, a competition in mental arithmetic between me and a large language model would be a complete joke, or a game of chess, or many, many other things. So they're vastly super intelligent in many ways already. But there's things that we can do cognitively that they can't do. They don't have a very good model of the world. They don't have much common sense. They're not as good at planning. They're not as good at changing their goals. These things will all change. And 20 years from now, I think we probably will have super intelligence. Maybe it's going to take a bit longer. There is this idea of Amara's law, which is the observation that we overestimate the short-term impact of technology, wherever we are, whatever technology we're dealing with, and we underestimate its long-term impact. So, and technology takes longer to get established than we think it will, because humans introduce inertia to the process. We have to get our heads around the idea of, you know, what this stuff can do, and we have to adopt it and deploy it. That takes time. But I think in 20 years, it's a pretty decent possibility that we'll have superintelligence. And I have a framework I call the four C's for thinking about what that will mean. And I think it's going to be the most important moment in human history ever when superintelligence arises. The first C is actually that it doesn't arise. So the first C is cease. We will stop making more and more advanced AI, and so there won't be a superintelligence. And really, if we were sensible, that's what we would do. And there are very smart, very eminent people in the AI space who are calling for this. Jeff Hinton's one of them, Stuart Russell, Max Tegmark, Yoshua Bengio. They think that superintelligence is very, very risky for humans, and therefore we shouldn't make it. We shouldn't go beyond something close to where we are now. We shouldn't go beyond tool AI. We shouldn't make AI which is independent and autonomous. And I think they're probably right, but unfortunately, their advice is going to go unheeded, because the incentive for building a better AI is enormous. Whatever contest you're in, whether you're a company or a government or a military, you know, having a better AI than the other person means you win. So we're not going to stop. So cease isn't going to happen. The second C is control. And that means we figure out how to make AI safe forever, so that it can never harm us. Because either we align it with our goals, we make it want the same things that we want, or we control it, we constrain it so that we can sort of slap its wrist if it ever starts to do something naughty and stop it. And these are two things which I personally also think are impossible. The idea of making certain that superintelligent AI never does anything that we don't want it to do just seems to me to be obviously impossible, partly because we don't know what our own goals are. There's 9 billion or so humans, and our goals are in many ways mutually contradictory. So we can't give an AI a set of goals, because we couldn't articulate a set that we could agree with, that we could agree on. And the idea of controlling an AI, which is many times smarter than us, thinks and therefore acts much, much faster than us, again, strikes me as being impossible. So that leaves the other two Cs. The third C is catastrophe. And that is where we have a superintelligence and it looks at us and thinks, I don't like you. And thinks, you know, it becomes like Agent Smith in The Matrix. It thinks that we're a virus. It would be a good idea if we didn't exist anymore. Or it's negligent. It's got all sorts of goals and ambitions, and we happen to be in the way. It happens to decide that on a particular day, the Earth should have no oxygen in the atmosphere. So it gets rid of the oxygen in the atmosphere, and that's us, done. There are all sorts of very unpleasant possibilities. And a man called Eliezer Yudkowsky has just published a book called If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies, which is a pretty neat summary of the most pessimistic approach. And I think we should take that seriously, the idea that superintelligent AI is an existential risk for humans. But I don't think it's inevitable. I think there's another possible outcome, which is that the superintelligence does become the most powerful species on the planet. We become the second smartest species on the planet, which is the position currently held by chimpanzees. But the superintelligence really likes us. It's grateful, perhaps, because we created it. It thinks we're very interesting. It needs a lot of data. It needs an ongoing supply of data, and we're 9 billion astonishing little data creators. So it decides to not only keep us around, but to help us. And it decides to solve or help us solve all of our major problems. So war, poverty, death. It helps us to abolish all of those evils. I personally think that we would find it dispiriting to be in a world where there was this astonishingly clever sort of big brother or big sister, and it was continuing to improve its mental abilities and was whizzing around the universe, exploring the universe. I think we'd get a bit depressed that we weren't able to play with it, a bit like a younger sibling. And I think our best future is that we merge with the machines at some point, which is it's a long-standing idea, is what Ray Kurzweil wrote about in the Age of Spiritual Machines. And for a lot of people, this is a horrible and frightening idea. But I think it's probably our best future. And I'd be dead chuffed if I was around to see it.
That could really scare people, because when I was talking to Peter, we thought that maybe there could be a silicon chip in our brains in the future. But that could scare a lot of people, in having AI in your mind, effectively, because if it's in your brain, it'll be in your mind, right?
A lot of people are very scared about this, and they think that there is something really essential about being human, something really important that we shouldn't let go of. I think being human is not the most important thing about us. I think the most important thing about us is what goes on in our minds. Being human really just means it's a biological statement, and it simply means that you are a member of a species and you can create new members of that species in the traditional way. And I just don't think that's the most important thing about us. And if it was possible to transfer my mind from this rapidly deteriorating body into a different substrate, which would never get old, and would only, my mind would only stop when I wanted it to, and it wouldn't stop just because of age. And I had many more capabilities because I had access to a huge amount of, mental space and compute. And I could whiz around the universe and explore the universe. I think that'd be terribly exciting. But I do appreciate that the whole idea is horrifying to many people, and not just religious people. All sorts of people who would describe themselves as humanists think that this is a nightmarish vision of the future. And I suspect that if we do get the positive outcome scenario, my fourth C, which is celebration, I think that there will probably be different. I think humanity will probably divide into different streams. There'll be some people who want to stay human, and they will probably augment themselves so that they don't have horrible diseases, and they will probably have considerably longer life than people do today. But they will still be recognizably human. And then there'll be another group of people who will upload their minds into computers. Of course, there's a whole philosophical question about whether if you upload your mind into a computer, does that perpetuate you, or have you just created a copy of yourself inside the computer? My view is that you do retain whatever personal identity is, which is a pretty iffy kind of a concept anyway. My view is that uploading does preserve the identity, but that is to be demonstrated. These are all, obviously, none of these things are going to happen tomorrow, and we've got plenty of time to figure it out, assuming we survive.
Yeah, I find your point quite interesting about the what we call a symbiosis between robots and humans. Is that the right word?
Well, not really. I think symbiosis is where two species remain separate, and they help each other. What it is that they normally do turns out to be useful to each other. That's a symbiotic relationship. I'm talking about an upload where we actually merge.
Wow. Do you think that's feasible in terms of compute power?
In terms of compute power, yeah. There's a lot of matter in the universe, and we do some pretty impressive things with our AIs today using a negligible fraction of the matter on this planet, never mind the rest of the universe. So would it be possible to create a computer with sufficient scale to host a human mind, or to host all of human minds? Yeah, I see no reason for that not to be the case, just in terms of available resource, and also in terms of energy. We capture a tiny amount of the energy that the sun produces on this planet. Whether it's technically possible depends on a lot more than that. Depends on whether we can figure out how to make these systems work. That's not something we're going to solve overnight. But in 100 years, 50 years, with exponential improvements in technology, yeah, very possibly.
Okay, and just bring it back to the present day, I thought it'd be interesting to ask you what tools you find useful. So which ones do you currently use and what do you find really useful for the audience to listen to?
Well, I suspect that your audience will include people who are much, much more sophisticated and savvy when it comes to the use of AI tools, because I'm not a Luddite, but I'm pretty unsophisticated. I use GPT-5, and that's the only LLM I use. I'm obviously very well aware that there is also Claude and Gemini and Mistral and DeepSeek and so on, but I just happen to use GPT-5. I have unlimited access to it, and I think it is pretty miraculous. I've never had a need to use any others. I mean, I've used some of the image-making tools, but now GPT-5 has got a pretty good image-making tool. So, yeah, that's the one I use. I use it a lot, probably 10, 20, sometimes 30 times a day. And I use it in all sorts of ways, some of which are quite surprising. I mean, I use it to look up information. I use it to translate things. I use it to help me think through questions when I'm writing. If I'm exploring an idea, I'll get it to help me think about where to go next with the idea. And I use it to help me think about issues I'm having with other people, whether I'm sort of trying to persuade somebody to do something or trying to persuade somebody not to do something or trying to make somebody happy in one way or another. And I find it quite remarkable how good GPT-5 is at giving advice about things like that. I'm pretty sure it's not conscious. There's a very strong consensus among neuroscientists, cognitive scientists, philosophers, that the current large language models are not conscious. And I don't have any I don't have any inklings of a belief that it is conscious, but it really understands how human minds work. It's read pretty much every novel that was ever written, pretty much every psychology textbook. So it knows a lot about how humans operate, and it's really, really good at giving advice.
So you're mainly using it for advice around your day-to-day activities. You don't use it for anything else, like do you use it for deep research as well?
Yeah, I use it for research. I use it to find things out. So I'm not a technologist. I'm not a coder. And my job at Quantium is I'm CMO, I'm chief marketing officer. So my job is to raise awareness of the company and what we're doing in the world at large. So I don't do any programming, and I don't do technology development. We have much cleverer people than me doing all that stuff. And they use all sorts of tools that I don't even know the names of.
Okay, fair enough. So in terms of one of the areas of your focus is safety and safety in AI, what current ethical principles do you think that we need to adhere to or keep an eye out in businesses? Let's say I'm a CEO, I want to roll out AI in my entire company. I'm doing it at speed. Everyone's using AI, but what am I missing?
Well, I speak to quite a lot of CEOs because of the talks I give, and what I hear from pretty much all of them is they understand that if they don't adopt AI now, then in 10 years' time, their company probably won't exist. Their people kind of know this, but they often find that the AI that they've tried, including large language models, doesn't quite do what they want. And people have a tendency to try a tool, and if it doesn't do exactly what they want, then they say, well, that didn't work, and then they put it down. And a surprising number of people have tried large language models, found them slightly disappointing, and haven't tried them again. And some of these people have, you know, tried it 2 or 3 years ago when it really wasn't very good, and they haven't got around to trying it again. So one of the biggest things biggest problems that CEOs have is persuading their people to keep experimenting with AI in their own lives and to keep using the AIs that the companies are developing. Another issue is of course, the large language models, although they are hallucinating a lot less than they did, they still do hallucinate occasionally. They make mistakes. I had a very interesting exchange with GPT-5 yesterday in which I asked it a question. It got one part of the question wrong, but that wasn't a problem. I knew that was wrong, and I didn't need to have it go back and check it. And then it gave me another answer to a subsequent question. And it reviewed its first question. And it said, by the way, my bad, I got this thing wrong when I answered your previous question. And I hadn't prompted that. I thought that was really interesting that it had gone back and checked its own homework and discovered it had made a mistake without me even hinting that it had made a mistake. I thought that was something I hadn't seen before. However, they're still not as good as they need to be for many purposes. And companies are trying to develop AI systems at scale. You know, we all know what large language models can do in our personal lives in the way as I've described. That companies setting up AI systems to perform the normal functions of their business, that's a harder, it's a more challenging thing. And often they haven't worked yet. They're still in development. And so there's a lot of skepticism among many, you know, among people working in companies, people working in organizations. And that skepticism is one of the biggest challenges for CEOs. But like I say, they know that they have to adopt AI because their competitors are. And if they don't, then they won't be around in 5 to 10 years.
Really interesting. So if I was to adopt AI today in my company, what sort of metrics do you think I should use to justify their success?
Business metrics. You need to improve your business. So what companies are doing is looking for problems which could be solved cheaper, better, and faster using AI. So if you automate a process and that makes it a lot cheaper to carry out, that's a win for the business. Or if you can offer information services that previously couldn't be offered, then that's a win. One of the big challenges, I think, going forward will be to avoid naive cost cutting. So it's going to be very tempting for businesses to identify people in their organizations who are doing robotic work, who are doing simple, repetitive jobs, which could be automated, and then just letting those people go. Those people are the talent in the organization for some time to come. Who knows how long, but for some time to come, organizations need talent. So the smart move is to have people automate the jobs that they're doing today, and then to declare those people heroes and heroines and give them another job to automate. Say, right, go and learn how to do that job and then automate that, and you'll get another pay rise for doing that. And then go and automate this other thing, and we'll give you a pay rise for that. And to redeploy the talent, use the human talent to do more and more interesting things. Because for some time, there are going to be things which humans can do and machines can't do. And so what you want is loyal, stimulated, interested, and happy, and people who feel that they are valued. You want them doing those things.
Yeah, I really agree. And I think if everyone has AI, then it kind of cancels each other out in terms of competitive parity, right? If everybody has AI tools, then the differentiating factor is the creativity you have in the workplace.
Yeah, I mean, you can also differentiate in your use of AI. If you use AI better than the next company, then you'll do well. If you adopt it, deploy it faster and more intelligently, then you can differentiate with AI as well. But certainly, humans are a big point of differentiation for organizations, for sure.
And what's one of the use cases that's really stood out to you in the last few years of how AI has changed businesses in general?
Well, the big one, which is still nascent, is self-driving cars. And we've been expecting it for a long time, but it's here. And I was in San Francisco recently launching a product and had a couple of drives in Waymo self-driving cars and was really, really impressed. And that's changing the nature of driving. We don't yet know how it will pan out. But one thing is, it'll save a lot of lives because we kill 1.3 million people every year at the moment with road traffic accidents. So that number will shrink to hopefully zero, but certainly a lot lower. But also, will we have a sufficient fleet of taxis waiting near all of us, so that you never need to own a car? You just get your phone out, tap in an instruction, and a self-driving car appears wherever you are and takes you to wherever you want to be. And that could be a very interesting world. Or will we all have our own self-driving cars because we really want to keep our golf clubs or whatever it is in the back of our car? We don't know how that's going to pan out, but it'll be an interestingly different world and a lot fewer awful accidents.
Yeah, interesting. And what other sort of ventures have you seen in San Francisco that really interests you?
I was really amazed by how the conversation in San Francisco was all about AI agents. I was at a conference, an AI conference, and everybody there was talking about AI agents, but it wasn't just in the conference. There were billboards with companies advertising AI agents to presumably to consumers. So that was quite surprising. I think, you know, people in Europe know about AI agents, but it's nothing like as top of mind. And one of the interesting things I heard about was I have a friend in the qualitative research industry there who was saying her business has been really affected by companies offering synthetic surveys. So, excuse me. There are companies which have created simulated respondents. So you can simulate not the whole mind of, but the opinions to a degree of a Manhattan banker or a Silicon Valley tech worker or somebody working in a factory in Philadelphia or whatever. And you can ask these kind of digital twins of humans for their opinions about things in the same way that market researchers ask humans. Now, if you're doing it with an AI, if you're doing it with a simulation, you can do it immediately. You can get the results back straight away. Is it as reliable? Nope. Is it cheaper? Yep. And is it faster? Yep. So some market research is now being done that way. Now, whether people will find that it's unreliable and so that it'll be an experiment which they stop, I don't know. I think probably not. I think some of the world's market research is probably forever going to be done like that now.
Yeah, I found focus groups really interesting. Creating sort of in advertising, you have brand lift studies. I'd imagine a future where brand lift studies before a campaign goes live is done by some sort of AI tools. So synthetic brand lift study. And then comparing it after and then recalibrating the predictions. I think that's a massive area. It looks like we're near the end of time. So I'm going to ask you one last question. And this one's for the audience listening. So it'd be a question from you to them that you want them to answer.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the first superintelligence should be conscious or not? Would you rather have the first superintelligence be a conscious superintelligence or a zombie superintelligence?
So you mean as ChatGPT is right now or Google Gemini is right now versus something that's really, really human, right?
Something that's got all the cognitive abilities of an adult human. Yeah. I doubt, personally, whether large language models on their own will get there. I suspect there's a couple of technological breakthroughs are necessary, but you never know. Let's say ChatGPT-10 comes along in 5 years' time and we realize, oh, this one is going to be super intelligent. There's going to be nothing that we humans can do cognitively that this can't do. Would we prefer it's a zombie or would we prefer that it's conscious?
Interesting question. Let's hear what you have to say in the comments. It'd be great to hear. And I just want to say thanks to Callum for his time because he's a very busy man. It's been a great conversation and I look forward to hearing more from you